Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, February 3rd, and here's the latest news reported by our staff correspondents overseas and in Washington, and supplemented by bulletin from the newsroom in New York. We switch first to our staff member in Britain. Go ahead, London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. London has just heard from Cairo that the enemy is still pressing back the 4th Indian Division in the Jebel Akhdar area northeast of Benghazi. Farther south, British mobile columns continued offensive activity. Military quarters in London have no confirmation of reports that the Japanese have crossed the Salween River in Burma. It's pointed out that the river is a fast-flowing one, and in the present rainy season, floods are likely to raise it quickly. And the only news that London has from Singapore is that the Japanese have carried out both dive bombing and high-level bombing raids. There's no official details on the damage caused. A few days ago, we were given the hope that Allied fighters would be able to put up some sort of protective screen over Singapore to keep the Japanese bombers from doing what they can do to a city that doesn't have fighters to guard it. The theory was that fighters could be based on Sumatra. Now it's reported in London that scheme won't work. Sumatra's airfields are said to be too far away, and if fighters could reach Singapore, they could only stay over it a very few minutes. It's said that it would take every fighter plane Britain has anywhere to keep up an effective defense of Singapore under such conditions. The Singapore airfields themselves are of no use whatever because Japanese artillery can be trained on them. Continuous artillery fire against the fields would make them useless. Long-range twin-engine fighters, it's emphasized, wouldn't be much use against ordinary short-range Japanese fighters. Without protecting fighters, Singapore's position looks very bad. Every city that has held out in this war against attack has had fighters to guard it. Tobruk did, and so did London, Leningrad, and Moscow. Warsaw, Rotterdam, and Belgrade didn't. The British are watching with great interest the constitutional crisis provoked in Egypt by young King Farouk. The British minister saw the king yesterday, and today Farouk is reported to be trying to form a new government. The 22-year-old monarch forced the resignation of the pro-British government of Siri Pasha over a quibble, the breaking of relations with Vichy. British observers say that King Farouk's loyalty to his country's alliance with Britain isn't above suspicion, and he's said to be surrounded by an anti-British palace clique. Certainly, news of Siri Pasha's dismissal isn't welcome in London. It was announced here this morning that formal British recognition of Haile Selassie as emperor of an independent Abyssinia is at last complete. The final agreement was signed in Addis Ababa on January 31st, and the British minister is going at once to the Abyssinian capital. For the first 2 years of the diplomatic agreement, the British are advancing Haile Selassie about $10 million. He's asked for British technicians, a military mission to help reorganize his army, and British judges. The army will be equipped with booty from the Italian army. The rigmarole of trying three former French premiers, Blum, Daladier, and Reynaud, as well as General Gamelin, will supposedly be carried out in Vichy, France, sometime this month. The idea is to blame them for France's defeat by Germany. The fact that the trial has been postponed several times may indicate how shaky is the proof against them. The former French isolationists, men like Pétain and Laval, are sponsoring the trial. But they, by refusing to admit the reality of the growing German menace to France during the course of years, helped condition French minds into that state of apathy, that don't-give-a-darn-for-anything feeling that was largely responsible for French defeat. To blame Blum for the fall of France, and at the same time to forget the stupidities, and in some cases the pro-fascist treachery, of 1,000 other military leaders and public men should be a difficult task for the Riom judges. Today France, the French newspaper published in London, prints the text of ex-premier Blum's letter to the Riom court, written last October. Blum calls the trial a mockery and says he's reserving details of his defense until the public hearing so he can justify himself before the world. He says the armament program of his government was ahead of schedule and that there wasn't any great disproportion between French armaments and the armaments the Germans actually used in conquering France. He says the court hasn't investigated military mistakes in using these arms or the fifth colonists that helped the enemy. Finally, Blum says that since his policies were approved by the people through their elected delegates, the Riom court is attacking not him personally, but the whole theory of republican government. It's been interesting to see the effect of Russian military successes on white Russians in London. Many of them haven't been in Russia since the Bolshevik Revolution, but they walk around with something of a swagger these days, as though to say, I'm a Russian and proud of it. Some of them are even organizing aid for Russia funds. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
And here are bulletins covering the latest developments in the Far East. Batavia. United States warplanes have again caught a Japanese invasion force in the Makassar Strait between Dutch Borneo and Celebes. A United Nations communique announces that at least two Jap transports were sunk by American bombers, and a third Jap ship was damaged and probably sunk. The American pilots made two separate attacks on a Jap convoy off Balikpapan, Borneo. This is the same region where Dutch and American forces pounded a Jap seaborne force for 4 days a week ago, causing heavy losses to the enemy. Presumably, the new Jap convoy under attack was bringing reinforcements to Jap units landed previously at Balikpapan. And the Japanese have carried the war into a new area today. 26 Jap bombers attacked the major naval base of the Dutch East Indies. The Japs raided airports of the Suriyaba naval base and struck at other towns in eastern Java. This is the first attack in Java, which is about 300 miles south of Borneo. 26 bombers were escorted by fighter planes. Singapore. The Japanese are pounding Singapore with steady attacks from the air. Apparently, this is the forerunner of an invasion attempt across Johor Strait. A communique says bombing activity has been considerable during the last 24 hours. The Japs are using high-level and dive bomb attacks and causing some fires. But the British say casualties are light. The British are maintaining a strict guard against infiltration tactics, which the Japs used to good advantage in pushing down the Malayan Peninsula. However, there's been no sign yet that the Japs are ready for a big attack by land. On the offensive, the British have sent bombers low over the enemy lines in Malaya. They've struck at Japanese motor transports speeding through jungle roads with supplies for the attack on the naval base. The British also attacked Kluang at the Malay Peninsula above the Johor Strait. Two formations of Japanese planes carried out raids against the city of Singapore itself this morning. 9 bombers were in one group and 27 roared over in the second attack. Moscow. The Red Army is driving westward on the city of Smolensk, some 200 miles west and south of the Kremlin. In this area, according to the latest Russian communique, Red Army units are in pursuit of two shattered German divisions. The Nazi retreat continues all along the line, and there's particularly violent Russian pressure increasing around the cities of Rzhev, northwest of Moscow, and around Kharkov in the upper Donetsk Valley to the south. Moscow radio says stiffening German counterattacks have been crushed and thrown back with bloody losses. At the same time, the Russians admit the evacuation of Feodosia in the Crimea. Soviet guerrilla fighters are credited with killing 200 German officers and men in weekend fighting around Kharkov. And Moscow says other guerrilla columns behind the German lines have cut off Nazi communications and isolated large German units. Once again, says Moscow, coal from the Donetsk Basin is moving northward over recaptured rail lines to the factories in Moscow. For word on events at home, here is Earl Godwin speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. You know, the president has picked a word for that advanced time, the daylight savings time. I thought he was going to pick the word victory time, but he didn't. He picked wartime, and wartime it is. I think possibly the subject which now has the leading incoming mail into Washington was that suggestion for an organized army auxiliary corps entirely made up of women, about 12,000 in number. Well, something's happened to it. Congress is now going to find out the proper places for women in the war. The House Military Affairs Committee calls Selective Service Director Hershey to the throne to ask him what steps have been taken to find out the proper places for thousands of women in America who are anxious and willing to serve and have experience and skill. The War Department had proposed a woman's auxiliary corps, that is, enlisted women soldiers to wear uniforms, live in barracks under soldier conditions, and be paid at enlisted men's rate, which starts at $21 a month, and of course, their uniforms and keep. But the idea has hit a snag in Congress. The Rules Committee of the House, which says what can and what cannot have precedence on the floor, has not yet turned on the green light for the measure. Meantime, Representative Tolan of California is going to ask Hershey about steps, if any, which have been taken in the draft to see that farm boys and farm workers generally are not drafted in too great numbers. Incidentally, I suspect that the thing which got in the way so far of the Woman's Auxiliary Corps is the idea that possibly the Auxiliary Corps will be used to crowd out some of the volunteer work that women are doing. And again, there's a possibility of congressional action to end all strikes during the war. That welder's internal dispute out there on the West Coast brings that up again in Congress. And in addition to that, the Navy finds its production running at reduced capacity because they can't get men to work full-time or a full crew of men to work on the dog watch. Day work is all right. Night work, okay, but that midnight to 8 in the morning shift is so unpopular that Frank Knox, Secretary of the Navy, says that only about 10% of production can be counted on at that time. Well, as I told you 2 weeks ago, this government is going to must lend China $500 million to keep the Chinese money from caving in. That's what they call stabilizing the currency. And wonder of wonders, the British government is reported to be ready to lend $200 million to China, too, because this is much more than a commercial matter. Five top flight officials, five cabinet officers will compose the flying wedge that will descend upon the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House today and tell the story. And these cabinet officers are Hull, Secretary of State, Secretary of Navy Knox, Secretary of War Stimson, Secretary of the Treasury, Morgenthau, Jr., and with them will be Federal Loan Administrator Jesse Jones. When that's finished, House approval of this measure can be expected very quickly, possibly tomorrow. One story about this money is that it might be intended to offset Japanese talk in China that this country is not extending sufficient aid to Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. Of course, a good deal of that is Japanese propaganda. And in order to show what the United Nations think of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, you know he has already been chosen as the Generalissimo of all war effort in his territory. But in addition to the merely mathematical and financial and economic reasons, the Chinese people are being deluged with clever Japanese propaganda, which asks them, why fight with these foreign devils from Great Britain and the United States? The Japanese say, we are willing to stop fighting with you, brother Chinese, and let us both turn on these foreign devils from those outlandish nations and beat them to a fare-ye-well. This story may be heavily denied, but they tell me on Capitol Hill, in informed quarters, that some of Chiang Kai-shek's officers have already been approached by Japanese and that they have been seriously affected by some of this propaganda. And so, this is a war move and a strategic move to bolster up the Chinese morale, because if Chinese buying power collapses, there would be panic, confusion, high cost, and chaos, and that would play right into the hands of the Japanese, just as it would do just as it would do Hitler a lot of good if this country should be thrown into confusion. Leon Henderson, price controller, puts a top price on washing machines and ironers, but the mule business thrives and prices go soaring. The old jugheads will win the war yet. A Tennessee congressman phoned me yesterday that a pair of Tennessee mules sold at nigh on to $600 a pair yesterday. Meantime, Henderson and the Secretary of Agriculture, Mr. Wickard, bury the hatchet. They agree to work together. Wickard comes down from the high ceiling of 10% above parity. He and price control Henderson state their effort is to produce an abundance of farm stuff at a fair price, and they did not mention parity. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And there you have the morning's news at home and abroad. Staff reporters heard on this program were John McVain from London and Earl Godwin from Washington. For latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
This is the NBC Newsroom in New York City, ladies and gentlemen.
And at this time, we hope to present an exclusive report from our staff member in Free French Africa. For this program, we take you now to Gordon Caskill in Brazzaville.
This is Gordon Caskill in Brazzaville, the capital of Free French Equatorial Africa, some 300 miles up the Congo River. It may sound stupid to say it, but I've just discovered another war. It isn't a big war, but it may be an important one. When I left Cairo a week ago, not even the brightest correspondent suspected that this war existed. Actually, it has been going on since last September. It's been fought in the strictest secrecy on both sides. At last, I've got permission to tell you a little about it, but only a little. It's being fought in one of the least known parts of the world, the mysterious Lake Chad region in the northern part of French Equatorial Africa. Somewhere, not even the mapmakers know exactly where, the Chad merges into Italian Libya. It was from the Chad that the Free French, almost exactly 1 year ago, made those daring raids against the enemy oases of Kufra and Mirza, marching 1,000 miles across waterless desert, one of the most amazing military operations in history. Even the capital of the Chad, Fort Lamy, is so remote that you can hunt antelope right on the airport. And the Shali River by the town is full of crocodiles and hippopotamus. This, then, is the setting for this small, unknown war. Here, the Free French are keeping up the fight, just as they did in Eritrea and Syria, just as they are doing now in the Libyan campaign. Since last September, there have been at least 30 engagements, mostly air raids. The enemy has been able to kill a lot of camels and a lot of French troops. He's caused a lot of damage, and you can be sure that it hasn't all been one-sided. The capital, Fort Lamy, had never been attacked before, but a few hours before my plane landed there, it had had its first attack. Despite the long, long months of waiting, Fort Lamy was on its toes and ready. The enemy pilots were smart, but not smart enough. They thought they'd catch Fort Lamy off guard. The attack just after noon, when most of Africa is lunching or taking its siesta. But the Free French gunners were ready. They gave the enemy a hot welcome. It wasn't a big raid. Only a single bomber came over. He dropped a heavy load of bombs, started some fires, killed one soldier, wounded some more, and killed some camels. One or two fighter planes would have finished off that bomber. The Free French asked for fighters at least a year ago. They haven't come yet. Maybe this doesn't sound like much to you in comparison with the other battlefronts of the world, but it may be very important. For one thing, where did that bomber come from? The nearest Italian or German base is so far away that it's almost impossible for a plane to make a round-trip flight without refueling. The map suggests the answer. You'll see that Vichy-controlled territory is less than 100 miles away. The Free French believe, sincerely, that the plane used the Vichy base in its flight. Vichy, of course, cries, no, no, a thousand times no. But, well, just take a look at the map. Before De Gaulle came, white men here never worked more than 5 hours a day. Today, I know a lot of Free Frenchmen who work at least 15 hours a day, and many haven't had a single day off since last summer. I've seen student pilots up in the hottest part of the day in old airplanes, learning to dive bombs. 2 years ago, they'd have been crazy to go out in such a sun. Well, they are crazy. Crazy to fight. Last night, I went to a farewell party for the happiest man in Africa. He was a young Frenchman who had just finished his plane and was off of the Libyan front. His eyes were like stars. But maybe you'll be killed, I tell you. He shrugged his shoulders the way Frenchmen do, and he said, anyway, that's the right way to die. Not like an old man dying in bed in Vichy. This, in the heart of Africa, is what Marseilles is talking about. This is really France. And now from Brazzaville, French Equatorial Africa, this is Gordon Caskill returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
NBC has presented Gordon Caskill reporting to you from Brazzaville in Free French Africa. This is the National Broadcasting Company.